Okay, today we will talk about a little bit about Japan in the second half of the 20th century, and we'll talk quite a bit about China in the second half of the 20th century. Okay, we'll take China up till basically today. We won't quite get Japan up till today, but we'll talk a little bit about it. Let's start our discussion with post-war World War II Japan. Remember that the United States occupied Japan after World War II for many years. And we helped rebuild the country. We helped them write a new constitution. In that constitution, the Japanese had been forbidden from maintaining an army. They were only allowed to maintain a small self-defense force. In the constitution, it disavows wars of aggression, so it forbids the Japanese from deploying their troops outside of Japan. So the few troops that Japan does have can only be used for the defense of the country in Japan. It can't be sent anywhere else in the world. This constitution also gave women the right to vote. And it really put Japan in a position that it was on the sidelines during the Cold War. Because the Japanese military was not allowed to ever be deployed anywhere else in the world, and because the Japanese military was essentially only a very small self-defense force, Japan could not really get involved in Cold War conflict, obviously. They were in no position to. Essentially, Japan's defense after World War II was the responsibility of the United States, as it continues to be today. The United States still maintains military bases in Japan and still takes responsibility for the defense of Japan. Okay? So Japan was basically on the sidelines during the Cold War. And this actually worked very much to Japan's advantage, because it gave Japan the opportunity to focus on the development of its economy instead of having to worry about global politics. Okay? Japan had signed a peace treaty with China in 1952 and reestablished relations with China, which would eventually be very, very important when China relaxed its restrictions on foreign investment. The Japanese have invested considerable amounts of money into the Chinese economy. And the Japanese signed treaties with the Southeast Asian countries that they had invaded during World War II. Part of these treaties that they signed with the Southeast Asian countries required the Japanese to pay these countries reparations, or pay them for the damage that they had caused in these countries during the war. Now, these reparations, which were basically intended as punishment for the Japanese, actually ended up working to the advantage of the Japanese. The reparations were to be paid in kind, paid in goods. And what this basically did is it allowed the Japanese to give the Southeast Asians free samples. Okay, imagine it that way. You know, like when you go to the mall and they give you a free sample, the reason they give you a free sample is because they're hoping you like it so much you'll come back and buy more. And that's basically how the reparations worked for the Japanese. They had to give them to the Southeast Asians. But what they did is it introduced these countries to Japanese manufactured goods, which ultimately led to the creation of new markets for Japanese manufactured goods. So it actually helped the Japanese economy. So during the 1950s and 60s, Japan really focused on the development of its economy, okay? Particularly in the industries of electricity. They built many, many hydroelectric dams to generate ample electricity for Japanese industry. The Japanese steel industry exploded, and Japanese shipbuilding exploded during this time period. So Japan became a major producer of steel and of ships. Japan was the number one producer of ocean-going ships in the world outside of the communist bloc. So of all of the non-communist countries in the world, Japan was the number one producer of ocean-going ships. So Japan's economy really recovered and excelled in the years after World War II, and ultimately led to Japan being one of the number one producers of manufactured goods in the world, one of the most industrialized countries in the world, and now one of the wealthiest countries in the world. Okay, let's go ahead and transition. We'll talk about China in the years after World War II. Okay, the People's Republic of China was established in 1949 after the end of the Chinese Civil War. If you'll remember that before World War II, a civil war broke out in China. The Chinese communists versus the Kuomintang, which were the Chinese nationalists. Another way of saying it is the Chinese nationalists. So let's For our purposes, we'll refer to it as the Chinese Nationalists, which were the Kuomintang under the leadership of Chiang Kai-shek, versus the Chinese Communists under the leadership of Mao Zedong. Mao Zedong's forces won and drove Chiang Kai-shek's forces and the Chinese Nationalists to the island of Taiwan. And in 1949, the People's Republic of China was declared. Okay, China became a communist country. China's number one ally in the world, once a communist country, was, of course, the Soviet Union. So from 1949 till 1956, the number one ally of China was the Soviet Union. But in 1956, major differences developed between the Chinese perceptions of communism and the Soviet perceptions of communism. The Chinese, under Mao Zedong, focused very, very much on the peasants, whereas the Soviets focused on the urban industrial workers. Remember that when Karl Marx wrote the Communist Manifesto, he imagined the social class that would rise up and overthrow the bourgeoisie would be the urban industrial workers. So the Soviets really focused their attention on developing this urban industrial class. Okay? Mao Zedong looked at the reality on the ground in China and said, actually, really, we're a country of peasant farmers. And so the peasant farmers are the oppressed class here. They're the workers in China. And so it's really them that are the supporters and the stalwarts of the of Chinese communism. So this difference, although it seems sort of almost silly to make such a distinction, ended up to be very, very important, though, and ended up to lead to pretty major differences in the or pretty major ideological conflict between the Soviet Union and the Chinese. Think about Stalin. When Stalin, you know, what he did to the Ukrainian peasants, he wasn't nice to them at all. You know, he didn't really care about them at all. You know, remember, they were starving to death. Well, Mao Zedong's focus was much more on the peasants, and he wasn't so concerned about urban industrial workers because he didn't really have very many. Okay? But there were some pretty strong, despite the fact that the Soviets and the Chinese didn't get along very well, there were some very strong similarities between the way the revolutions rolled out in the two countries. Mao Zedong, like I said, focused more on the peasants and was more concerned with developing small-scale industry on the village level rather than building these massive industrial cities like the Soviets did. Mao wanted to have industry, have manufacture, but have very small-scale manufacture in the villages so that the peasants would actually stay in their villages and they would work in small-scale industry instead of in these large cities in massive factories. And he did follow the same basic policy of Stalin with the collectivization of the farms. Mao ordered the collectivization of the farms in what he called his Great Leap Forward. If you think of Stalin's five-year plans, essentially the equivalent of Stalin's five-year plans in China was Mao Zedong's Great Leap Forward. Okay? It was this plan to communize the economy of China. The Great Leap Forward had two basic strategies, two basic things that it was to accomplish. One, it was to create village-level, small-scale industry. Okay, so small factories in each village where villagers could come work. Okay, and then to create massive farm collectives, to collectivize agriculture into very, very large state-owned farms. Now, here's where Mao Zedong made his mistake. He decided that China's biggest asset was its population. China had plenty of workers, tons and tons of workers, in fact, because China had a huge population. So rather than adopting the labor-saving technologies that the rest of the world was using, tractors and industrial machinery, Mao utilized human labor. So he created these massive collectives, huge state-owned farms. And rather than sending in all kinds of technology to help increase agricultural output, he put a ton of workers on the farm in the hopes that a massive amount of labor could produce more agricultural output. Well, that's true. If you put enough people out there, they can do the same work as tractors and industrial machines can do. Enough people can accomplish the same type of things that a machine can accomplish. However, machines don't eat, and people do. And when you put a whole bunch of farmers on the farm, then the food produced on that farm is consumed by the farmers, and then there's not anything left over for everybody else. So Mao Zedong's policy actually worked against him more than it worked for him. Okay? Mao's goal was to create agricultural surplus. He did. But all that agricultural surplus was consumed by all of the farmers that he put on the farms. And there wasn't anything left over for everybody else. So there was massive shortages as a result of the Great Leap Forward. So the reality is that the Great Leap Forward was actually a Great Leap Backwards. And Mao Zedong's reaction to the failure of the Great Leap Forward was actually quite ridiculous. Mao Zedong said that the reason the Great Leap Forward was a failure was because squirrels, rodents, and sparrows were eating all of the grain. And that's why there wasn't enough grain to go around. So he ordered his people to kill the squirrels, rodents, and sparrows in China because they were eating more than their fair share of the grain. So the Chinese people, thinking that Mao had all of the answers, went off and launched a campaign to kill sparrows, squirrels, and rodents. Well, the problem was is that sparrows were actually eating more insects than they were grain. So when they killed the sparrows, the insects started to reproduce, and so then there was a whole bunch of insects which were actually eating the crops. So then it was even more of a failure. So the Great Leap Forward, like I said, was a complete and total failure. This became quite apparent by 1962 when 30 million Chinese were dead because of starvation resulting from the Great Leap Forward. Okay, so really we need to think of Mao's Great Leap Forward as a big, huge Great Leap Backwards. Because his Great Leap Forward was such a failure, he really needed to sort of do something to sort of re-inspire his people to support him. So in 1966, he organized the Cultural Revolution. The Cultural Revolution was, I guess, a huge propaganda campaign. That's what it was. It was a huge countrywide propaganda campaign that basically mobilized the youth of China to reinvigorate the ideals of the Communist Revolution. What Mao was afraid was that communism and the sort of the patriotism attached to communism, the pride in the people and the belief in working for the common good, would stagnate in China, like it was beginning to stagnate in the Soviet Union. Immediately after the Communist Revolution in the Soviet Union was incredibly successful. The people believed in the movement. They believed in fighting and working for the common good. But over the years, that belief sort of petered out, and the people started to think, what am I getting out of this? And they started to become much more individualistic again, as humans tend to do. So the purpose of the Cultural Revolution for Mao Zedong was to reinvigorate those beliefs, those ideas of the work for the good of society, believe in equality, fight for equality. So the Cultural Revolution was this massive propaganda campaign in which he organized the youth into the Red Guard. And these were basically cheerleaders for the Communist Revolution. And what they did is they attacked their teachers, they attacked their parents, and they attacked anybody that they saw as possessing bourgeois values. Okay, remember, bourgeois is the middle class. So any adult who was seen as being selfish or greedy was attacked, sometimes physically. Sometimes they were arrested and even executed. But usually they weren't attacked physically. They were publicly humiliated. They would be paraded in the streets with dunce caps on, with big signs on their on the dunce cap, which stated why they had been, why they were being humiliated. You know, this teacher is very, very greedy, and he tells his class to save money instead, or to, I don't know, to work for themselves instead of to work for the good of the whole. I don't know, I just made something up. But anyway, this was this massive propaganda campaign aimed at rooting out the bourgeois values, or the selfishness and the greed in society, and to reinvigorate the ideals of equality and work for the common good that had developed during the Communist Revolution. And it was largely led by students. During the Cultural Revolution, religion was very, very much suppressed. Individuality was very, very much suppressed. I mean, you can see this in the photograph of the young women holding up the little red books. Mao Zedong's teachings were contained in this small red book, and it was just a collection of quotes from Mao Zedong, and every Chinese person had it and was expected to read it and carry it with them all the time. And this was essentially, it essentially became the Bible of the Chinese people, because religion was being suppressed. Temples were being destroyed all over China. The Red Guard would go into Buddhist temples and destroy Buddhist statues and destroy the temple in general. And so what Mao Zedong was attempting to do basically was replace himself, put himself in the place of religion. And the new teachings came from the Little Red Book. And individuality was suppressed. It's during the Cultural Revolution, the Chinese people all started dressing the same. You can see this in the picture as well. If you lived in China during this time period, you would have worn a Mao suit, a blue jacket with blue pants and a blue hat. Everybody wore the same thing, okay? Including Mao Zedong himself. The Cultural Revolution lasted until about 1970s, and it started to sort of peter out, though it continued to some extent until 1976, when Mao Zedong actually died. But during this time, during the Cultural Revolution, China did make some important decisions. In 1971, diplomatic relations opened between the United States and China. Remember that in 1956, the relationship between the Soviet Union and China pretty much collapsed. So China didn't have a really good buddy in the world. So in 1971, our president at the time was Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon opened diplomatic relations with China and actually took a trip to China. The American ping pong team went to China and competed with the Chinese, and diplomatic relations were opened between the United States and China. This made the Soviet Union very angry, but it established the relationship, or it laid the foundation for the relationship that the United States has with China today, which is a very, very important economic relationship. Because when the Chinese eventually reformed their economy and allowed foreign investment, the United States was one of the first countries to be able to enter and invest in China and to build factories in China. Okay, so that all that foundation for that relationship, the relationship we have with China today, was laid in 1971 when Richard Nixon, our president, traveled to China. But like I said, Mao Zedong died in 1976. Many of the radicals who had supported the Cultural Revolution were arrested, including Mao Zedong's wife, and a new, much more liberal government took power under the leadership of a man named Deng Xiaoping. When Deng Xiaoping took power, he very slowly started to decentralize the economy of China. He saw what was happening in the Soviet Union. He realized China's economy was in big trouble, and he very, very slowly started to institute reforms that decentralized the economy. In 1978, Deng Xiaoping allowed one province in China to allow firms, companies, to compete freely. Okay, rather than production and prices being set by the Central Committee, these firms were allowed to compete. Prices were set by supply and demand. They were allowed to work to make a profit. And it was incredibly successful. So shortly afterwards, Deng Xiaoping instituted these reforms throughout China. Now, they were still government-owned companies, However, rather than their production and their prices being set by a central committee, production and prices were set by supply and demand, okay, which was basically like the perestroika reforms that Gorbachev instituted in the Soviet Union in the late 80s, okay? But China did this much, much earlier in the late 70s, okay? These reforms continued. China allowed the accumulation of personal wealth, so individuals could work and become quite wealthy. The managers of these firms were actually making decisions based on how to maximize the profits of that firm, and then they could enjoy those profits, so they were profit motivated. So individuals were allowed to accumulate wealth. Factory management was allowed to make decisions on production and prices. Foreign firms were allowed to invest and to operate in China. Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and the French airplane manufacturer of Airbus were among the first foreign companies to establish locations in China and to start doing business in China. Though they were limited to special economic zones, they weren't allowed to do business anywhere they wanted. They had to open in these sort of special zones that were allocated for foreign-owned businesses. The communalization of farmland was ended, and although people couldn't privately own land, they were allowed to lease the land from the government. So individuals and families were allowed to lease land and to operate the farms for their own benefit. By 1984, 93% of the farms were in private hands in China. So no longer were the large state-owned collectives producing the farm goods or operating the farms because they were incredibly inefficient. Now all of the farms were being operated by, or 93% of the farms, I should say, not all of them, 93% of the farms were being operated by private individuals or families who had leased land from the government. Between this, all of these reforms were incredibly successful. Okay, between 1980 and 1993, the industrial output and the agricultural output, I believe, I think the total output, actually, the total GDP, gross domestic product, of China doubled. And China's production increased by 8% per year. That's tremendous. This output being increasing by 8% per year between 1980 and 1993 is really pretty tremendous. If you consider the fact that world output increases by only 1% per year, so China was just increasing on a massive scale. Now, this doesn't mean that the average Chinese person was all of a sudden thrust into an incredibly better life. Remember, China has a huge population, and even though overall output was increasing, and when I say overall output, I'm talking about agricultural output and industrial output combined. Although that was increasing, remember, China has a huge population, so the average person was still basically relatively poor. Okay, though there was a development of a Chinese middle class. Chinese factory managers and Chinese who were working with foreign companies that were becoming quite wealthy. Okay, as time progressed in the 1990s, there was massive investment on the part of U.S. businesses and Japanese businesses in China, and this is when, you know, the Made in China came to be. American corporations started to open factories in China because the cost of labor was so low. Japanese corporations started to open factories in China. But again, most of these factories were in designated areas for foreign investment. They weren't able to open wherever they wanted. They had to open under relatively tight government regulations, but still it is massive investment. There's a tremendous number of foreign companies doing business in China. It all starts in the 1990s and continues on a massive scale today. Despite all of this foreign investment and despite these local controls over the economy being granted to factory management and farms being leased to private individuals, China still essentially has a command economy. Okay, remember, a command economy is when the government controls the economy. Okay, essentially, most of China's major industry is still government-owned, okay, and still government-controlled. However, there are growing sectors of private business. So what's basically happening in China today is the two systems, the free market system that we have and the communist command system, are coexisting in China. Some industries are directly controlled and owned by the government, while other industries are privately owned. Some prices are set by the government, some prices are set by supply and demand. So the two systems are coexisting in China. The command economy is still the largest economy in China, but the capitalist free market economy is growing in China. So China is very, very slowly transitioning from a communist command economy to a capitalist free market economy. Because of this, China has managed to survive as a communist state, whereas the Soviet Union has collapsed. And China's economy has steadily grown, whereas Russia's economy has really, really struggled. What happened in Russia is Gorbachev instituted the reforms too late. By the time he instituted those reforms, it was really too little, too late, and it wasn't enough to save the communist system. And then when communism collapsed in the Soviet Union and Russia became an independent country, they privatized everything right away and tried to go from a completely communist system to a completely capitalist system overnight. And it was a disaster. And so Russia has really been trying to pick up the pieces since 1991. And things are getting better in Russia, but still there are some real, real problems with its economy. China, on the other hand, has made this progression from a communist command economy to a capitalist free market economy very, very slowly, okay? Allowing some private ownership of business, allowing some privatization of farms, even though the land still technically belongs to the government and you have to lease it instead of own it, allowing foreign investment, but limiting that foreign investment to with pretty tight government control, okay? Now, these economic reforms in China have not been accompanied by social reforms. When Gorbachev instituted perestroika, the economic reforms in the Soviet Union, he also instituted glasnost, which were the social reforms, allowing freedom of speech. And he instituted demokratiza, which was political reforms. Political reform and social reform have not occurred in China. China is still very much a totalitarian government when it comes to civil rights and political power. Okay? The Chinese Communist Party still is very much in control of the Chinese political system. Okay? And the Chinese Communist Party still does not allow very many civil rights, like freedom of speech or freedom of the press. They still suppress these things. They even, to some extent, suppress things like freedom of religion, though they're kind of chilling out on that now. But they're very, very much firmly in control of the government, and it is definitely not a democratic system. This became very, very clear. It became very, very clear that China had no intention in moving towards a democratic system in 1989. So remember, China started instituting all of these economic reforms in 1978 and has progressively instituted more and more reforms all the way up till today. However, they did not institute any political reforms. And when political reforms were demanded by the people of China in 1989, it became very, very clear that they were not going to get those reforms. In 1989, hundreds of thousands of protesters, Chinese protesters, marched to Beijing and met in Tiananmen Square. Tiananmen Square is sort of the equivalent of the national lawn. If you've been to Washington, D.C., and you know that big grassy area out in front of the Lincoln Memorial, think about that. That's like our equivalent of Tiananmen Square. Tiananmen Square is this big open area where they have parades and meetings and stuff in the capital of China, Beijing. Well, hundreds of thousands of protesters had converged on Tiananmen Square, and they were there to demand democracy. They wanted China to institute democratic reforms to give the people of China a voice in Chinese government. You can see this in the bottom right-hand picture. There you see the white statue that was the goddess of democracy, I believe, is what they called her. And she was sort of the symbol of democracy. And mostly these were Chinese students demanding democratic reform. Well, the Chinese government responded by calling in the military and sending tanks into Tiananmen Square, opening fire and killing hundreds of protesters, and dispersing this protest using tanks. So it became very, very clear to the world that China was not going to institute any democratic reforms and still has not instituted any democratic reforms. So China today, in China today, the communist government is still very, very much in control of the political system. There's limited civil rights. However, the economy is continuing to transition from a communist command economy to a capitalist free market system. Okay, so we are done for today.